All right, well, good evening. We're feeling extremely quarrelsome, I think, up here. And we'll try and pretend we really dislike each other. I should mention that here is further proof of the takeover of the world by argumentative Indians. And it's very nice to have the opportunity to talk to Amartya today. And I'm sure that unlike the liberals Paul mentioned, he will be able to defend his own ideas, but I'm certainly going to ask him to do so. What we're going to do is just, I thought you should know a little bit about this really extraordinary man before we tear him apart. Amartya was born at Shantiniketan. Shantiniketan, you may know, is the university that was founded on the property of Rabindranath Tagore, the Nobel laureate for literature, and is an extraordinary kind of university in India, that people have lessons under trees, and it has a very kind of a different ethic. What I remember, one of the things I remember about it is that at the heart of it, or there's where Tagore used to live, that there are three houses around different sides of the same courtyard. One is in a kind of Japanese style, and one is in a Western style, and one is an Indian style, and Tagore used to simply go like this, and the whole household would have to move from one house to another, but it was just across the same courtyard. So this kind of triple self of Rabindranath Tagore, it seems to me, is in a way exceeded by Amartya Sen, whose polymathic abilities are deeply irritating to those of us less gifted. He is a Sanskritist. He has spent much of his life studying not only economics but also mathematics and physics, and indeed had to at certain points in his life decide whether he wanted to be a Sanskritist, a mathematician, a physicist, or an economist, and I know exactly how that feels. And how difficult a choice that must have been. And he has, you know, of late, managed to, in a way, use this diversity of self to write a couple of really quite, I think, very important books, The Argumentative Indian and now Identity and Violence, books which take on some of the big subjects of our time, such as where ideas of democracy, pluralism, tolerance come from, and whether they are indeed Western ideas or whether you can see them having roots elsewhere in the world as well. And certainly his argument is that you can see in the Indian tradition a tradition of argument, of discourse, of tolerance, of multiplicity, of the understanding of pluralism, which has nothing to do with ideas imported from the West. And so to see these as being exclusively Western ideas is a mistake. We'll go into that a little bit more. And we will go into his thoughts about the relationship, extremely central to the way I think we're all thinking at the moment, the relationship between identity politics and violence in the world we now live in. Of course, migration is has to be a theme when looking at Amartya's life. I mean, you spent some of your childhood in Burma, is that right?
That's right, three years in Burma, in Mandalay.
Yes, so where you, at the age of three, became close friends with George Orwell. and then immediately left. then there's a passage in England, including being Master of Trinity College, Cambridge, and now in America, at Harvard. Well, actually back and forth to America, but presently in America at Harvard. So, I mean, it's clear to me, I've always felt, that people who have that experience of transcultural migration clearly have to think perhaps more than others about the question of identity, because the way in which the self conceives itself has traditionally a lot to do with place, with roots, you know, with the place you come from, the language you speak, the community in which you find yourself, the customs of that community. And migrants lose all that, or often do, and have to, in a way, question what wherein their identity lies. So let's just start with that and ask you, what, if anything, was the consequence for you of migration, and what did it make you think about self, yourself?
Well, it certainly made me very aware of a couple of things, that there are lots of people with whom I am very friendly, going back to my age three, not perhaps George Orwell, but others around, who had a different identity in the sense that if they were to define themselves as a Burmese, they would look, you know, they would be very different. And yet, at the same time, we did share a lot of identities together, not just the identity of human being, but being concerned with usual things, where you might be able to get a good ice cream. And, you know, these uniting factors, which give us a different way of looking at it. So that was one concern. The other concern, of course, that the you mentioned about India and democracy and so on, I think my thesis in some ways is even more ambitious. I'm even beginning to disagree with you in the sense of broadening, to say that I think they have really arisen almost everywhere in the world. The idea that somehow participatory governance, what Mill called government by discussion, that's a very general idea. And I think in India what is very special is that, and this is where the verbosity of Indians come in, I mean, we after all hold the record of the longest speech ever in the United Nations, 9 hours non-stop.
It was Krishnamenon.
Krishnamenon, yes, that's right. Yeah, no, every one of these, I mean, Mahabharata is often compared with the epics, Iliad and Odyssey. Mahabharata is 7 times Iliad and Odyssey put together.
Yes.
If it can be said in 2 pages, you mustn't say it in a line.
True.
So I think, given that, there's a lot written on the subject of secularism, democracy, and so on, which are general thought, going back to the Buddhist period, the early Hindu period, as well as after the Moguls, particularly the Moguls, a lot of discussion. So, and Tagore, to whom you referred, had this wonderful passage saying the idea of India militates against the strong sense of separateness from one, from other people. So in some ways that was very much part of the thing that that came up, both in my family as well as in school. And having the experience of going to Burma and then traveling within India, of course, and then eventually going to Britain, that kind of solidified more. So I think it played a very big part. Not so much in... I've never had a sense of a fragility of Indian culture that somehow acknowledging as anything else would immediately make my Indian identity go away. I mean, I think that is a completely invented problem.
But do you think that the Indian... I mean, this question of the Indian identity...
Yeah.
Isn't that itself not that... I mean, quite a recent invention? That's to say... Historically, there was no India. There were a number of nations there which often fought with each other, and even when the British, when the Mughals ran India, they never really controlled the whole place, and when the British ran India, they hardly ever controlled the whole place. And the Indian national idea, you could argue, is quite a recent one.
Well, I think now Paul would be very happy, because I can disagree with you.
Yes, go. That's what I'm trying to do.
I don't think so. The first book on India by Megasthenes is called Indica. What the hell was he writing about?
Well, he's writing about a geographical area, but
well,
is he writing about
geographical
a cultural
area?
Entity?
He was describing these people to the Greeks. What do the Indians do? When in 7th century E. Jin, the Chinese visitor, after spending 10 or 11 years in India doing Sanskrit and also studying medicine, as it happened, went back, his last thought is a very pleasing one because he had met a lot of Indians. He said, "Have I come across anyone in India who does not admire China?" Now, this is quite interesting. Actually, the phrase was, "Have I encountered anyone in the 5 parts of India, 5 parts of one country, that does not admire China?" So I think he was noting diversity and yet saw a unity.
So
11th century, 1012, I think, AD, certainly very early 11th century, the first book, really serious book on India, which I think is probably the best book yet written on India, is Al-Biruni,
yes,
the Iranian traveler, what is called Tariq al-Hind, the history of India. That's all happening before Norman conquest of Britain, I might point out. So there is a sense of Indian identity that is being seen by outsiders. And in fact, the whole term India, of course, is a foreigner's invention.
Yes.
In the sense that they had to signify it, and they saw Indus as a river. Now happens to be mostly in Pakistan. But they defined that whole area as India. So I think in some ways, the how others see us have been a very important part of a kind of self-definition.
Yes. This is early multiculturalism from the 11th century.
Yeah.
All right, let me just push it a little further. It seems to me if you look at the history of, let's say, India before the Mughal Empire, and again, India after the great Mughals, at the period which British power is increasing, what you see is dissension. What you see is war. And in fact, one of the ways in which the British were able, as we know, to develop a hold over India was by renting themselves out in a mercenary way to fight for Prince A against Prince B and get land in return. You know? So isn't this a little utopian, your notion?
I don't think it's utopian. It depends on what the notion is. Mm. If the notion is, was there a modern sense of nationalism on the part of Indian, I think that would be completely wrong to think. Absolutely not. Was there a lot of dissension? You know, I mean, there were things like that going on, War of Roses, Crimean War, hundreds of things in Europe and within Britain too, between the Scots and the English and so on. That didn't prevent its development of a sense of the British. So I think it's a similar thing to look at. But I think in a sense, Salman, it's very good that you're focusing on the Mughal issue, because I think in some ways it's basically Akbar, late 16th century, that marks a kind of definitive view of an identity of India. Because if you think about what are the projects that Akbar had, this is the Muslim emperor, the grandson of Babur who established it, he is trying to get not only a unified calendar. In my argumentative India, and I discussed 32 major calendars going back to a long time, with a lot of shared features. From 4th century AD, there is a principal median defined, which runs through Ujjain, and it's often not recognized, since we will get irritated by India being 10.5 hours different from here and 5.5 from Britain. Well, it is still the same principal meridian. The Indian standard time is the Ujjain time, fixed in 4th century AD. Now, the calendars agreed on that, but otherwise the calendars were different, some solar, some lunar. Akbar tried to have a unified Indian calendar. You know, it would be the Tariq Ilahi, just as he also wanted a unified Indian religion, which would draw on Islam. He didn't cease to be a Muslim. But you draw in Islam, but also other religion, and not only Hinduism, but also Parsis and Jains and Jews. I mean, he had all of them. So there is that. But I think what I would emphasize is that that's not happening in vacuum, though. 14th century, Amir Khusraw, a great Muslim scholar, very interested in Indian identity. What did the Hindus do, and how we can think of an Indian identity? Late 14th. In 15th and 16th century, these poets, Kabir, Dadu, Ramdas, Ravidas, Mirabai, these are all talking about a kind of holistic understanding of India. And on top of that, you see, if you think about the rulers, the main Muslim kingdom before that, of course, are the Pathans. Now, it's the Pathans who did some of the, it's again often forgotten, especially by Hindu sectarians, that the first, I mean, we are very proud in Bengali, we have some really excellent epic translations of Ramayana and Mahabharata. How were they ordered? They were ordered in 14th century by the Pathan kings.
Yeah.
So Pathan king ordered that Muslim kings of Bengal, they were ordering a translation of the Sanskrit epics into Bengali. And again, there is a kind of focus on what
unites people as opposed to what divides. So I think as long as we are not insisting on modern kind of nationalism, there's enough of a basis of unity there.
Well, like you, I do, you know, I always admired what Akbar, the so-called Grand Mughal, did in the way of that kind of synthesis, which you also see in the art of the period, attempts to synthesize art from different parts of India and so on. And the religion that he invented, which kind of didn't catch on, one has to say, which was the kind of synthesis of the religions, the so-called Deen-e-Ilahi. People did say that there was an element of megalomania in this, that in Fatehpur Sikri, his capital city, over the great gate of the Buland Darwaza, the great gate of Fatehpur Sikri, there is the inscription Allahu Akbar, which of course conventionally translates as God is great, but by only a small semantic stretch translates as Akbar is God.
That I think is a little unfair. I really do think it's unfair.
It was said about him even at the time. but yes, it is unfair. But then,
but it was said by the Delhi Muslim priestly caste.
Yes,
that's
yes,
basically what's happening.
History has a way of being unfair.
Yeah.
The question I wanted to one of the things I think I wanted to talk to you about is which comes out of Akbar. Is the way in which the Indian idea of secularism differs from the Western idea of secularism in some interesting areas. But to get to that, I just wanted to say that this is, you know, we're talking about a long time ago.
Yeah.
And if you look at more recent events in India, sectarian violence has been at the heart, you know, of all our lives, you know. And in your own case, of course, the partition riots were extremely formative.
Yeah.
And you tell very movingly the story of an encounter with the victim of violence.
I wondered Muslim if you'd like, laborer yeah, killed.
Perhaps you'd like to share that with.
Yeah, well, no, that was when I was in 11. I was in Dhaka, which was then the second city of Bengal, and now then later became capital of East Pakistan, now the capital of Bangladesh. So we lived. The regions were not entirely separated, but it was a primarily Hindu region in which we lived, not far from the university where my father taught, and not far from the courts where my grandfather used to practice. So I was playing in the garden when suddenly came a chap, profusely bleeding and obviously being slashed by a knife, and asking for some water and some help. And I was looking after him until my shout got my father down, my mother down, and my father took him to the hospital where he died. But it was an extraordinary thing, and I was talking with him. He was actually had his head on my lap while I was drinking water, and he was telling me, and that was actually quite important for my understanding of economics and the role of it too, in that very early days in my. I remember thinking when I was thinking about maths, physics, or economics, that there was some issue there. That he said that his wife had told him not to go out to an unfriendly area, but there was nothing at home to eat, and there was an offer of a job, and he was on his way there, and he was nearly there, when these thugs stopped him and killed him. And the interesting thing, the thoughts that it generated were, all kinds of thoughts. One is the complete incomprehension as to why some people will kill this guy whom they have never met before, just because one identity, their different religious identity, was such a dominant thing. Secondly, while in terms of religious classification, that's a very different identity from the Hindus there. And yet, if you look at the tally of the victims of riots, the easiest people to kill are, of course, the poorest, who don't live in sheltered houses, who have to go out to work. So the biggest victims of Hindu violence were Muslim poor, and the biggest victims of the Muslim violence were the Hindu poor. Their class identities were much the same. Their religious identities were extraordinarily different, but class was not allowed to count. But this whole thing that the wife had told him, the sensible thing, don't go out in the state. He had to go out because economic necessity.
He had to earn a crust.
So that made me also see how you can't think about freedom at the same time
thinking about the economic freedom as being a component of it.
Well, we're circling round to this, to the key subject here, which is the subject of identity and violence. I just wanted to mention, I remember talking about another moment of extreme religious violence in India, the moment in Assam of the so-called Nelly killings, when there were the famous photographs of the massacred children of a particular village which had been raided by their religious enemies, so to speak, I've never forgotten these photographs that appeared in the Indian press and internationally of the bodies of children laid out in neat rows, having been slaughtered by these marauding villagers. And I remember being in India at the time and talking to a group of writers, including the great Kannada novelist Anantamurthy.
Oh, yes.
And the thing he said is, which I've never forgotten, is he said, we must understand that we are all guilty of these murders, that if any Indian is able to do this, then all Indians are capable of it, and therefore the guilt belongs to all of us, that there is, if there is in us that capacity which allows us to kill our neighbors, you know, then it is in all of us. And until we understand that, we understand nothing about what happened. I mentioned this because it runs counter to your desire to unify that world, and just to point out that the divisions there do run very deep and burst out in these bursts of violence.
Yeah, the divisions run deep and they don't. If you think about the Hindu-Muslim violence itself, the forces that I'm describing, they came with the suddenness of a storm and then they disappeared. Mm. Bear in mind that the Hindu-Muslim riots were not standard features of Bengal at all.
No. But the storm keeps coming back, Amartya. The storm comes back in
Gujarat.
Well,
the storm comes back, and that's why I think eternal vigilance is not the price only of liberty, but of other things too. Yeah. But you see, bear in mind that, you know, this breaks up. I'm talking about 44, what I was telling you about earlier. But it's, at that time, 2 or 3 years old, this violence. 47, India is partitioned. By 1951, my city of Dhaka, not only there have been no killings since then, but also they're a completely different issue. Now Bengali nationalism, wanting separation, bad treatment of Bengalis in Pakistan, that becomes the issue. And the streets are full of agitation about a different cause, mm-hmm. the cause of Bengali literature, culture, and so on. So I think the depth of it, you see, if you take it to be really so deep, that it cannot be moved, it would be difficult to think of it. I mean, there obviously was an irresistible force that did move that object at some stage within 3 years. That's an extraordinary thing. So I think the important thing here, I would argue, is that when it happens, that absolutely seizes you, whether it's Hutus and Tutsis, or whether it's Serbs and Albanians, it's gone on for a long time, Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland. It may drown every other kind of identity. And yet when it's gone, you may wonder, what the hell was that about?
Yes.
So I don't see them as powerful. We make them more powerful by assuming them to be so deep, so ingrained in human nature. And the subtitle of my book is The Illusion of Destiny. And I do want to emphasize that, and I think but for Norton discouraging me, that might have become the title of the book too, but Norton took the view that
they
wouldn't
they
be clear about the one.
They were right.
They were right, yeah. Okay, all right.
Yeah. Identity and violence,
but you see, my main thesis is that what we take to be destiny is not only an illusion, but actually that illusion has an absolutely terrible effect, because it makes people paralyzed from action, and you take it for granted. And then, you see, one of the things that's happened now, against this clash of civilization and the Hindus and Muslims and Christians must be at loggerheads with each other, instead of clash of civilization, the defense comes not saying, well, Muslims and Hindus and Christians have many other identities too, as scientists, as people liking literature, etc. Instead of that, there becomes a new program. Yes, take this one identity seriously, but now you have amity between civilizations, dialogue among civilizations. You first reduce human beings into one miniaturized form, member of a civilization, doesn't matter anything else, then amity, not clash.
Well, that's, I think this brings us to your book. I just do want to say that you have spoken and written very eloquently about the sectarian murders in Gujarat. We all know about the continuing violence in Kashmir. It does seem as if this kind of sectarian violence bursts out fairly frequently. And you're right. There's the next. I mean, in Old Delhi, where Hindus and Muslims live side by side, one day they can be murdering each other's children, and the next day they can be happily opening their stores and, you know, chatting to each other. And it is, to me, one of the great unexplained mysteries of human nature that we are able to, flip between these two things. Let's not belabor the point. You've gone on to talk about the central idea of identity and violence, which is that, in fact, we are not one, we are many as individuals. You know, as in the famous formulation of Walt Whitman, we contain multitudes. And do we contradict ourselves? Very well, we contradict ourselves. I just wanted to let people hear. There's a passage in the book which gives a good exposition of this idea about how many things we can be, and what it means. So would you like to read this for a few minutes?
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. I have to make clear that my own book is not my favorite reading. Always, but when I'm commanded to do that, I do that. Being a good boy.
Read.
Yeah. This is a chapter called Making Sense of Identity. A history and background are not the only way of seeing ourselves and the groups to which we belong. There are a great variety of categories to which we simultaneously belong. I can be at the same time, and I'm afraid it's autobiographical a bit, same time an Asian, an Indian citizen, a Bengali with Bangladeshi ancestry, an American or British resident, an economist, a dabbler in philosophy, an author, a Sanskritist, a strong believer in secularism and democracy, a man, a feminist, a heterosexual, a defender of gay and lesbian rights, with a non-religious lifestyle from a Hindu background, a non-Brahmin, and a non-believer in an afterlife, and also, in case the question is asked, a non-believer in before life as well. This is just a small sample of diverse categories to each of which I may simultaneously belong. There are, of course, a great many other membership categories too, which, depending on circumstances, can move and engage me. Belonging to each one of the membership groups can be quite important, depending on the particular context. When they compete for attention and priority over each other, they need not always, since there may be no conflict between the demands of different loyalties, but when they do, the person has to decide on the relative importance to attach to the respective identities, which will again depend on the exact context. There are two distinct issues here. First, the recognition that identities are robustly plural and that the importance of one identity need not obliterate the importance of others. Second, a person has to make choices, explicitly or by implication, about what relative importance to attach in a particular context to the divergent loyalties and priorities that may compete for precedence. Identifying with others in various different ways can be extremely important for living in a society. It has not, however, always been easy to persuade social analysts to accommodate identity in a satisfactory way. In particular, two different types of reductionism seem to abound in the formal literature of social and economic analysis. One may be called identity disregard, and it takes the form of ignoring or neglecting altogether the influence of any sense of identity with others on what we value and how we behave. For example, a good deal of contemporary economic theory proceeds as if in choosing their aims, objectives, and priorities, people do not have or pay attention to any sense of identity with anyone other than themselves.
John Donne may have warned, no man is an island entire of itself, but the postulated human beings of pure economic theory are often made to see themselves as pretty entire. In contrast with identity disregard, there is a different kind of reductionism, which we may call singular affiliation, which takes the form of assuming that any person preeminently belongs, for all practical purposes, to one collectivity only, no more and no less. Of course, we do know, in fact, that any real human being belongs to many different groups, through birth, associations, and alliances. Each of these group identities can, and sometimes does, give the person a sense of affiliation and loyalty. Despite that, the assumption of singular affiliation is amazingly popular, if only implicitly, among several groups of social theorists. It seems to appeal often enough to communitarian thinkers, as well as to those theorists of cultural politics who like to divide up the world population into civilizational categories. The intricacies of plural groups and multiple loyalties are obliterated by seeing each person as firmly embedded in exactly one affiliation, replacing the richness of leading an abandoned human life with the formulaic narrowness of insisting that any person is, quote-unquote, situated in just one organic pack. To be sure, the assumption of singularity is not only the staple nourishment of many theories of identity, it is also, as I discussed in the first chapter, a frequently used weapon of sectarian activists who want the targeted people to ignore altogether all other linkages that could moderate their loyalty to that specially marked herd. The incitement to ignore all affiliation and loyalties other than those emanating from one restrictive identity can be deeply delusive and also contribute to social tension and ultimately violence.
Well, passage does, in a way, is what you explore throughout the book. And let me just start out by saying what I agree with.
Paul would be disappointed if you stop there.
No, of course. We'll not stop there.
No.
But we will start there. Yeah. And it seems to me that as a novelist, one of the things that has been always clear to me is that, unlike novelists in, let's say, the pre-Freudian age, who believed in character as something unitary, you know, a person was what he was, and in the immortal, you know, in the immortal words of Popeye the Sailor Man, you know, I am what I am, and that's what I am.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to me that Popeye had not read Freud. just a theory. otherwise, he would know that, in fact, we are much more fractured than that, and that as selves, we're a kind of bag of selves, and we contradict ourselves. And, you know, put it simply, the way in which we are with our parents is not the way in which we are with our children. The way we behave with our employers is not the way we behave with our lovers. The way we behave towards our friends is not the way we behave towards people we don't like. No, we have, all of us, a whole series of behaviors which different groups of people would perceive as ourselves, and yet might in fact be very different. You might be a very aggressive employer, but a very timid husband, for example. And yet that would all be you. You know, so I think in that sense, it's quite clear that we do, as you say, cover a lot of different, or contain within ourselves, elements of different, to use a mathematical term, set. You know, and this, it seems to me that your theory is not unlike, in some ways, mathematical set theory. You know, and you begin to draw these circles and see how many circles we all belong in. The problem is, you talk about a great deal when you go on from this about the, and you, it was in that passage too, about the importance of choice. You say that basically what we all need to do and do is to choose the relative weight that we impart to our different identities. I mean, in theory, it would be possible to meet an Islamic radical who was a Yankees fan. And therefore, even though you might oppose his Islamic radicalism, you would have Yankee fandom in common, unless you were a Mets fan, in which case, bad luck.
Yeah.
You know, not this year, but anyway. However, given that we do all, you say, need to make these choices, and we do make these choices of the weight we give to things, I just want to just question how much of this choice-making is free choice, because all kinds of things weigh on us, including peer group pressure, including the way in which we are perceived by others who describe us to ourselves, and it's sometimes very hard to escape from that description. Given that we don't come naked into the world, we come into the world, you know, we are conditioned to an extent by our upbringing, and that conditioning makes it harder to make a free choice. And so isn't this question of choosing really, in fact, quite a limited thing? And I wanted to just, is it, for example, would you say, only a privileged group who are able to make such choices? Is it class-based, for example? Is it only a very highly educated elite class that can make such choices? I mean, is it excessive to believe that as human beings we can all make such choices?
Yeah, well, I think it's a very good question. But I don't think, if you take it as a rhetorical question, then I disagree with it. Namely, that I think the ability to think of ourselves in these plural terms is a very generic ability. It's probably almost as wide as what Chomsky discusses, our ability to understand syntax and language. If you look at the history of it, I mean, some of the people I discuss are privileged people. Ashoka in 3rd century BC, an emperor. Akbar is another emperor, and so on. And theorists like Abul Fazl or Amir Khusrau, obviously intellectuals, Gandhi, Tagore. And yet quite a lot of the movements have come which go against sectarian identity react. If you look at the history of Akbar, it's very interesting in some ways. The beginnings of it include intellectuals, both Muslim and Hindus. Amir Khusrau is probably the biggest name in 14th century. 14, 15, 16, who are these poets I was referring to? These are very common people. Kabir is a weaver. Dadu is a cotton carder. Ravi Das is a cobbler. These are initially folk songs arguing against the division between Hindus and Muslims being taken to be more serious than it is. It's also religious poetry, and yes, they are also community-based poetry. Now that becomes a very strong movement around the area. Now there is an apocryphal, possibly, we don't know, story that Akbar had a 40-day meeting with one of them, Dadu, who was born a Muslim, cotton carder, and became one of those things and started a group called Brahma Sampraday, which you can clearly indicate that he was crossing also various boundaries. So well before Akbar himself held these major Agra discussion at a time, between the Western religion, and a time, if I may say with some pride, exactly at a time when these discussions were going on, Giordano Bruno was burnt at the stake in Rome, Campo dei Fiori to be exact, for apostasy. So at that visionary moment, preceding that, he had already had conversation with a cotton carder coming and lecturing him. And it too, you may think that by Allahu Akbar he was praising himself, but a guy who was ready to listen to a cotton carder, but successful poet, having something to say, asking him, what the hell do you want to say? And so I think this is the reason again and again. And just one of the things I should mention, my grandfather had a book on Hinduism, which was I translated in 50 years ago. And he discusses how the question of amity has often come in the different communities from very common people. But it's true even today. There's not a single one of the riots that I can think of that had rural origin. They're basically urban phenomenon. They're disgruntled urban. I think Marx would have called them lumpen proletariat, is often the cannon fodder, often the pedestrians who are the foot soldiers who are recruited for that. But they're always theory thought of. I mean, the Hindutva-based violence to which you referred in Gujarat and others, you can trace it to the ideas theorists, Savarkar and others, and not to rural thought. There's not a single riot that actually originated in the rural area, and that was true even in the 1940s. They're generated in the cities. So I think in some ways the lower classes get a bad press in this. I don't think it is the case that it's a privilege of the elite to think in these terms. When the last elections were going on, 2004 in Indian general election, which was a very important one because the first general election after the Gujarat riots, and actually the party most implicated did lose office. But I remember traveling around in Bengal because I have a trust too, which does some work on schools and hospitals. And I remember talking with a person, very poor, possibly illiterate, and I asked him how was he viewing the election. He said, "Well, I hope we do speak up." We were discussing exactly that issue. And then I said, "Well, do you think we will?" And he said, "You know, I ought to tell you that it's not very hard to silence us. But that's not because we cannot speak." I think the distinction he was making, that it is not an endogenous inability to understand these issues or speak up. If we don't speak up, it's because we are afraid. We are cowed down by others, either by propaganda, by the architects of violence, or by state machinery. He would be arrested.
Well, that's just the point, is that if there are such pressures as fear working on us, to what extent can we make these choices?
Well, but that is the role. I mean, I know that you played that role, and I think we, in a smaller way, all play that role, namely to stand up against that. And that if there is any, at the moment, there are all kinds of things. I mean, one of my worries at the moment is that there is a kind of unholy alliance between Islamic extremism on one side and Western parochialism on the other side, both of them taking a very, very similar view of the, you know, a Muslim is a Muslim, and you know, they're going to kill us, or it's our duty to kill them. And I think we have to speak up and, you know, talk about the variety of identities that we have as intellectuals and, you know, acknowledge to being one. And yet, a lot of the leadership would have come from what you hear people talk about in the streets of Calcutta. You're too much of a Bombay Wallah to recognize what are the most things that are talked about as we walk around in Calcutta, maybe in Bombay.
Well, I understand that between these cities there's entirely healthy mutual contempt. But at least in Bombay, the sidewalks don't have 10-foot holes in them. That's a little side.
I have to do a retaliation from a Bengali, actually, adopted Bengali. My friend Salma Soban telling me, because she was very upset like I was when Bombay renamed itself and called itself Mumbai.
Yes, ridiculous.
And we thought it was ridiculous. And Salma said, "You know, Master, when you think about it, it's not a bad effort on the part of someone trying to say Bombay while looking for his denture."
Yes. Right. I have a feeling that we could go down this side road for quite a long time. But maybe we should not. Just to drag us back, of course, side roads in Calcutta, they're all side roads.
Yeah.
There are no main roads. Sorry.
Yeah.
The question in your, again in the piece you read about singularity and about the what you clearly would describe, I think, as being an error to allow oneself to be put into just one box, you know, whether that's a box of of religion or race or class or nation or tribe or whatever it may be, but that singularity you could describe as a kind of error.
Yeah.
A kind of error of self-description.
Yeah. Its main problem is an epistemic failure first, before it becomes an ethical failure, too.
But what happens?
Yeah.
Let's take the example, as an instance, of the July bombers in England. What happens if that singularity error is the choice made by the individual? What happens? You're saying that we must make choices about the weight we give to our different identities. What if the choice we make is that only one of our identities matters, and that only one of our identities is relevant or truthful or powerful or necessary as a basis for action? If that is the free choice made by the individual, which you say the individual should make, to reject pluralism, to become singular, and the consequence of that is an event like that, an event like a suicide bombing. I mean, you can't. If you are advocating free choice, then that must be something that you would have to respect, rather than calling it. Is that a mistake? Is what I'm saying, or is it a choice?
I think that's an excellent question. I think we're pushed in different directions. And take the July 7 bombing. I was actually in London on that day. In fact, I had gone in the same direction as Piccadilly. I was catching a Heathrow plane to go to Frankfurt that day. And this happened a little later when the Piccadilly line was blown up and the buses and so on. Now, if you look at it, there are really several distinct things to look at here. The worrying thing, of course, that shook the British, that these were British-born, Britain-reared, educated, in Britain, children who had grown up to have that sense of dissonance with the British community. On one side, there is the pressure from Islamic terrorism and recruiting them. And actually, one of the things that's overlooked now that the warm memory of the empire is making such a comeback in everywhere, how much of the legacy of empire, the sense of having been badly treated when the European powers could divide Middle East or Africa as they like, just draw a line and the countries would be different countries, how much of that the Islamic terrorists really draw on. So there is that. I mean, on top of that, of course, there is homegrown dogmatism on the Islamic side. And yet, if you look at the other side of it, what is the British policy doing? The British were very visionary in many ways. In unlike the French, had by and large, all colored people resident in Britain have a vote, because coming from Commonwealth, a subject of the Queen, without British citizenship, the vote. I vote in Britain. And that immediately gives me a sense of identity. That was very well done. The pension, the National Health Service, far less discriminatory, if I'm any judge, compared with the French. And yet, they also decided at that time, and I think that was high theory, that the best way of looking at multiculturalism is this plural monoculturalism stuff, so that for the sake of a mechanical parity, just that there were Christian schools paid for by the government, there would be Muslim schools, the Hindu schools, Sikh schools. Not just that these schools, I mean, they're coming up very fast, but their evil effect we will see in the future. But that mentality that led to that line of thinking. I mean, I'm a great believer that British identity is a very important thing for people to pursue at that time, without denying any other kind of identity. You know, you may be a Muslim, you may be Hindu, you may be a Labour Party, or you may be something else. But this unique identity of being a British Muslim, this became a big thing. I was absolutely horrified as I was catching my plane to hear the government appealing the British Muslim community to get its act together. That's an invitation to British Muslims not to act as British citizens in the civil society, the comprehensive undermining of which is one of the problems we see everywhere from Europe and America to Iraq, but this is the kind of deliberate undermining of it, asking people to act within the religious community, go and meet your imams and tell them to be moderate rather than extremist. That's the line. I was called up by a Bangladeshi friend, and he said, I just heard the Prime Minister appealing to me not to act as a member of the Labour Party,
not to act as a member of the Transport and General Workers Union, but as a Muslim, and I must go and visit the local imam, whom I have never visited, because I'm a British Muslim, and it is my job to get him to be moderate.
Yeah.
Now, I think this whole discourse plays, I think, a devastating role.
Yeah, but I agree with you. I think on the subject of the pathetic Blair government, I don't think we'd have any disagreement. But what I'm asking you to accept is that these boys, oh, I have to tell you, I don't know, I think it should be more widely known that the joke that entered the internet within 24 hours of the July bombings was the two British Muslims go into a sporting goods store and try on rucksacks. And Muhammad says to Abdullah, "Does my bomb look big in this?" I think it was actually very healthy that the humor began within 24 hours of that event. It was a very British reaction in many ways to that event. But the fact is that these boys decided to strip away from themselves all their other available identities. You know, their identities as, if you like, British, as the children of their parents, as the brothers of their siblings, as, you know, cricket players. One of them certainly had some talent in that department. You know, whatever other selves they decided, they chose to be this self, you know. And I'm not sure that you can explain that away entirely by outside pressure on them, because one of the things we now, even the British police are saying, is that they didn't seem to have any real links to Al-Qaeda, and they seem to get all this stuff off the internet. What would you say to those people if you had the chance, if you were up there with the 72 virgins? Or as we now know, raisins.
Yeah.
The mistranslation for the Aramaic.
Yeah. But, yeah, my Aramaic is a bit rusty, so I won't comment on it.
Well, this is, I must say, it's one of the very few reasons I can think of for believing in an afterlife is to see the look on the faces of people arriving with an expectation of virgins and being offered a bowl of dried fruit.
Yeah. I don't think the virgins play a very big part in this kind of violence that you're looking at. I don't think whatever these four Pakistani origin Muslim boys, but British citizens, were doing, I don't think they were looking for virgins. I think they were looking for a sense of what they see as a justice. And they I'm glad you asked the question, because I'd like to turn it around and saying that that's what makes the identity show so important, that it was strongly instilled on them that it's true they have a British identity, but, you know, the British are doing pretty well. Look at the unfortunate creature in the world, the Muslims all around the world. For 1,000 years, they might have been the strongest power, but, my God, they're absolutely nowhere. They can, Europeans and the Westerners can do what they like with them, and we ought to change that situation. So there is a strong sense of commitment. So much of the terrible things happen along with a mood of self-sacrifice. They were self-sacrificing people. I don't think they are looking for virgins primarily. I think they are looking for doing something which they think is the just thing to do. And that's exactly why civil society is important, and that's exactly why the multiplicity of identities and the fact that there are demands from identities are so important. You know, I think there have been, you see, at the moment, if you think about it, the global movement, about the only non-religious, say, Islamic terrorism, but there were others too, like, Hindutva is a world movement too, Vishwa Hindu Parishad is a world movement, the Sikhs have been world movement also,
But they're world, world movements in the sense that the World Series is the World Series.
Well, that may apply to the Hindus and the Sikhs, but the Islamic is much, much wider. Yes. But I think the only opposite group, of course, are things like anti-globalization people. Yeah. I think the odd thing are the two things: the pro-globalization, as it were, world capitalism is a great unifier. Business is the point that David Hume noted, that as you do business with others, you come to know about their existence. You can hardly overlook the fact that they exist. Mm. And similarly, anti-globalization people, these are not local boys of Genoa and Seattle. They come from everywhere, from Adelaide to Kuala Lumpur,
so
to come and protest. They are a different
globalist.
Kind of identity, globalist. They are. Anti-globalization movement is the biggest globalized movement in the world today.
All right, good.
To their credit. And I think even those who don't like their economic rhetoric should see that they provide an alternative way of thinking about one's global identity. So I think there are all kinds of other things happening. It's just that what this singularity thesis does is to reduce everything to non-existence, you know. And I think this is what I think the Clash of Civilization, or for that matter, the Amity of Civilization theorists try to do.
All right, good. I'm glad you got there, because now we can come to some of the people who don't like what you say.
Yeah.
Far be it from me to say that I agree with them, but I'm going to be them for the moment.
Sure.
You mentioned the Huntington's thesis, the Clash of Civilizations thesis. One of the people writing about your book, and I think the Washington Post...
Critically, very critically.
Yes, said that essentially you're offering this worldview, the worldview of the pluralism of self, the pluralism of identity, and the importance of recognizing and fostering that. Right? To simplify his argument, he says that there is no momentum behind that idea, that what you call miniaturization, the singularization of identity, is actually where all the momentum is right now. That's actually what's happening in the world, you know, rather than what one might wish to happen in the world. That's in fact what is happening in the world. And given that the Huntington thesis, the Clash of Civilizations thesis, is a much more persuasive description of the world we live in than yours. And that, I mean, I don't think he uses the term, but it strongly suggests that yours would be a kind of wishy-washy liberalism, whereas that's the kind of tough truth, you know? Mm-hmm. What do you think of that?
Not much.
No. I just wondered in what terms you might think.
I don't know the gentleman in question.
Fuad Ajami. Fuad Ajami. I don't know him either. But
he's a well-known guy, I guess.
Well, he knows himself anyway.
Yeah. I don't think I agree with that. You know, I think he would find it greatly difficult to explain many things that's happening today, even in Britain. It's a very small faction of the population has acted the way, even of the Muslim population in Britain, had acted the way that the July 7 bombers did, a very tiny fraction. And across the world, everywhere you see that, it's just that that's inflated and there's an attempt to pump it up. And if, in addition to Islamic terrorists pumping it up, if Western parochialists to join hands to pump it up, I have reason to protest. It's not because they're winning anyway, and I don't think they can win anyway eventually, but it's not the way the world is. I mean, take India. It's a country of...
But sorry to interrupt. When you say it's not the way the world is, it is the way the world is.
No, I'm not. I mean, it's the way the world is in the sense that it's the way some people think the world is. Mm. And that's a feature of the world, that these are... Mm. You know, people don't often recognize how special their own position is. Mm. Can I tell you a story on that?
Yeah, please.
Okay. One of my favorite stories, which is also connected with that. I think it probably figures in the book somewhere. This is about the difficulty about people not understanding how others see them. And this is a story from Italy. My late wife was Italian Jewish ancestry. And she died a loss of illness. Her father was killed by Mussolini, by the fascists. But this is from the time when the fascist party in the 1920s is making great inroads in the rural areas in Italy. They're doing propaganda and asking people to join the fascist party. And there's an Italian rural simpleton whom this fascist recruiter gets hold of, and he explains why he should join the fascist party. And this guy says, well, I can't join the fascist party. It's impossible because I'm a socialist. My father was a socialist. My grandfather was a socialist. My great-grandfather was a socialist. I cannot possibly join the fascist party.
To which this person said, this is an extremely silly argument if you think about it. Imagine if you were, if your father was a murderer, if your grandfather was a murderer, if your great-grandfather was a murderer, then what would you have done then? To which he said, then of course I would have joined the fascist party.
Yeah.
So I think people don't have enough self-think. But what I was pointing out, Salman, is that if he is viewing India the way he thinks the world is,
yes,
how would he explain? We have had ups and downs. We have had our share of riots, and people have fought it. It's a big issue. Bangladesh is a big issue going on right now. Now, in India, we have 82% of the population is Hindu. If you look at the three principal positions of government, the president of the country is Abdul Kalam, a Muslim. The prime minister is Manmohan Singh, a Sikh. The leader of the ruling party is Sonia Gandhi, a Christian born in Italy. And there would be no way that in, I shouldn't say Fuad's world, because I don't know him other than this review, that in this world that you could imagine this be possible.
Mm.
One of the big things that happened in Pakistan, by the way, Bangladesh's separation from Pakistan was not on grounds of religion, not on grounds of literature, culture, as well as secularism. If you look at Pakistan, one of the biggest things that happened in the subcontinent over the last 10 years is the emergence of an independent and largely secular press. The powerful papers, the Dawn, the Daily Times,
yeah,
the News, the Nation.
All of which used to be official mouthpieces.
Yeah, they're all changed. Mm-hmm. And if I think about one of my great gurus, a great Urdu poet who you knew,
yeah,
Faiz Ahmed Faiz, who was one of the early leaders of Pakistani thought and Pakistan editor of Pakistani Times. He was arrested and he eventually died. And that he would have been absolutely delighted. This is what he was trying to do in the 50s and 60s. Mm. But this has happened in Pakistan. And it's to ignore all that as if not exists. And I can understand. I'm shocked, of course, that every time the leader from Britain or America visit, they would never visit a member of the civil society. They would confine themselves to political leaders and military leaders, and in the case of conveniently in Pakistan, they are the same. So that they don't have to travel very far to see them all. On the other hand, I wish they would spend the undermining of civil society, mm-hmm, which is taking such a hard toll in Iraq, is something also cultivated by ignoring altogether everything else. And the Fuad Adami way of looking at it, I shouldn't say that, but Huntington's way of looking at it, pushes us in the direction of forgetting everything else, just that one way of looking at war, and the war on terror in this case.
So that's told him. I think in a way, let's just look at this, because I think it's another serious criticism from another fan in the Wall Street Journal, is that you whitewash, if you like, the failings of Muslims. That people like Mr. Sen says, overlook Muslim or Islamic failings for fear of appearing unsecular. Any political conflict in which one side is characterized as Muslim is automatically disparaged as being anti-Muslim. And so on. In other words, that by saying that we have many different identities and maybe the bits of us that are doing the quarreling are not the religious ones, that you're letting off the hook the Islamic ideology, which in the view of the critic would be responsible for a lot of what's going on. So early Islamic Arabic breakthroughs in mathematics are held up as proof of intellectual greatness. But why did the Islamic world flounder into a state of long-running anti-scientism? Mr. Sen compares the very best of the non-West with everyday practice in the West. This is a common problem with the defenders of Islam. Then it has some class jibes at you about how upper class you are.
Yeah.
You know, one Bengali is a poet, two Bengalis are a film society, three Bengalis are a political party, four Bengalis are two political parties, both leftist.
a very flattering description.
You know, and kind of so untrue. So horribly untrue.
Yeah.
Anyway, question of whether are you soft on Islam? Well, and if so, why?
I don't think I am. I think Islamic terrorism is causing a tremendous amount of vast nastiness and violence in the world today. But, you know, I think where my disagreement is to see in the history of Muslim people, which is not the same thing as Islamic history, nothing other than that. I mean, one of the oddities, I mean, what he's referring to here, for example, I was mentioning the fact that when an American mathematician today does an algorithm, he may or may not recognize, he or she, that he or she is commemorating the memory of a Muslim mathematician of the 9th century called Al-Khwarizmi, from whose name algorithm comes, and from whose Arabic book Al-Jabr Al-Muqabila comes the term algebra. Now, so I think what this guy is saying, he's saying, yes, but why did it die out?
Because it's true that every time people praise the great achievements of Islam, they all happened 600 years ago.
I think it's a mistake to... okay, but I would say, but I'd have another take on that in addition to the one you're taking, it's wrong to think of them as achievement of religion as such. It's certainly true that Islam gave a kind of a political unity which made this possible, with a very liberal kind of flowering of a society possible. But it's also true that it would be wrong to think of Al-Khwarizmi as an Islamic author. He is not. Indeed, not only in British schools of Christian variety is Al-Khwarizmi anything about him mentioned, but in the newly found Blair's Islamic school, they're not taught either, because that's a part of Muslim history, not a part of Islamic history. Now, I think the question is that it's been overwhelmed, and I think in this the empire did play a part, and so if people don't recognize what kind of forces generated, and if Muslim violence is fed by that, I try to argue Indian how James Mill's vision of India directly feeds into the Hindutva extremism that we see today. So I think there's a kind of dialectical relationship there. But that's not to in any way to overlook what terrible things are done in the name of Islamic fundamentalism today. I agree with my friend Mamdani's thesis that fundamentalism is not the same thing as terrorism. Mm. But in translating that, yes, there is a propaganda going on. But rather than saying we blame them all, we have to see what is the way to intervene. I mean, the so-called war on terror is going on without engaging civil society anywhere, starting with elections without any kind of discussion, when media is completely haywire in Iraq. I mean, when all that's going on, to pursue that ideological issue rather than the political issue of our different identities, and that we can interact again, you know, if you have a decent media, if you have a unions, if you have occupational groups, etc., it would take a very different form. You know, I think the history of it, Fuad also raised this question, looking back historically in that review, and I think one of my critics in the Wall Street Journal did too. There were several letters published on that, said that I refer to the fact that the Jewish philosopher Maimonides, when he had difficulty in Spain, he went to Cairo. Now, it was, Fuad Adami thinks that this is a telling point against me to say that the difficulty he had in Spain came from Islamic rulers. Now, that's true. That, of course, never denied. There was a change. I mean, 9th century Caliph Abd al-Rahman with the Jewish vizier Saprut did some of the finest multicultural work in 9th century world in the world. But 11th century, again, 12th century, it's changed. But the interesting point is, where did he go? He did not go to Britain. He didn't go to France or Germany. Richard the Lionheart was fighting the Crusades against Saladin. Maimonides didn't go to Richard the Lionheart. He went to Saladin and was given a position in his court, became a court doctor and a high-ranking official there. Right. So I think my point isn't that there isn't a lot of skeletons in that cupboard. Mm. But I think when the Western parochialists say that in the history of Muslims there's nothing other than intolerance, yes, that is, I mean, as you pointed out earlier, that, and that's I want to emphasize that, that's to start with an epistemic failure, a complete confusion about the nature of history about that period. And then it also generates an ethical and a political failure today.
Yeah. If I could just bring you forward 900 years. Just for as a last question before we ask the audience to intervene. If this is your desirable goal, the fact that we should shed singularity of identity, that we should resist miniaturization of the self, and that we should seek to comprehend ourselves as broadly based multiple identities with much more in common with each other than we might otherwise suspect. In a moment in the history of the world when we seem to be going the other way, when we seem to be more and more defining ourselves narrowly, whether that's, you know, Serb, Croat, Bosnian, whether it's India, Pakistan, whether it's the West against Islam, whatever it may be, we do seem to be going in the other direction. Okay? So the question then is, how do we reverse that trend, and how do we begin to get where you want us to go?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think I will disagree, I mean, without denying the importance of the question, the practical reason, what should we do? There's also, I'm not sure I acknowledge that we are moving in the opposite direction. There are many different things happening. There are very vocal people and very violent people, in fact, on both sides, which are pursuing one type of cause. But other things happen. I was very privileged for 3 years to be president of Oxfam. And a number of thousands of people, volunteers from different countries, going to incredibly difficult places. It's amazing, actually, as to how much sacrifice they would make. And suddenly I found myself, I was a member of this group that was started by Ted Turner and Sam Nunn called Nuclear Threat Initiative. One of our meetings was taking place when the Afghan operation began. And suddenly I found I was sitting among people in Washington who were extremely well informed, extremely well connected, but I knew more about it because I was still the president of Oxfam. Because that morning I had phone calls and there were 18 of our people in Oxfam in Afghanistan. Mm. And I had more information on that. From the nature of the information, it's quite clear how precarious they were. But there they were, and they, as you know, actually, they went on fighting. Happily, we didn't lose anyone in Afghanistan. We did lose somewhere else. But at that time, they were trying to carry out relief operations to people not of the same color, not of the same religion, don't share anything other than a broad identity of human being, which became a big one, which is a very big factor in that. And that's all happening. And anti-globalization movement, I mentioned, is just one of them. And there's a different face of religion. I think missionary activities have often been very concerned with educating people, sometimes, of course, pressurizing, but at the same time, also, there's a big general trust on education, which we should not deny, as in some ways, some of the Hindutva group, anti-Christian Hindutva group, has tried to misportray them. I think there have been globalized movements of a really important kind, and they continue today. I think, therefore, I will reformulate the question, what can we do to strengthen it? Now, there, I think, I do believe that clarity is a great enemy of sectarianism. I do believe that. There's a peculiar passage of Wittgenstein, which is actually difficult to interpret. I know there's some distinguished philosophers here in the audience who might be able to weigh here. I quote it from memory, saying, I sometimes wish I was a better person, i.e. more informed and intelligent. Now, you don't think that being informed and intelligent is necessarily make you a good person, but I think there is a point that's being referred to there. There's a connection that's being drawn, that a lot of our nastiness comes from inability to understand, lack of clarity, and so on. So that's the direction I would like to go.
That's a very fine answer for a writer to give.